Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. We're continuing with a summer theme we started last week on the arts. And my guest today is Harvey Terrace. He is Dean's Professor for the Public Humanities and English at Syracuse University and the author of a new book titled Conversations About Beauty with Ordinary Americans. Somebody Loves Us All. Harvey, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So let's just start with the basics. I mean, what's the basic structure of this book? What are people going to find there?
Well, they're going to find conversations with folks who are almost all from Syracuse. And I asked them a lot of questions about their encounters with beauty, more broadly their aesthetic experiences. There's a guy who fixes up old cars, women who knit, the leader of a local choir, a community activist, a lot of different kinds of folks.
I want to come back to that Syracuse angle in a minute, but let me ask you this other question first. How'd you get the idea to write it? What inspired you to want to do it?
Well, let me tell you a little story. That's how I like to explain the genesis of this book, and I'm going to go all the way back to my years as a student at Cornell University. Okay. During the height of the anti-Vietnam War movement, and when all of these events were swirling around us, including African-American students taking over the student union in order to protest not having an African-American studies department, when all of this was happening, I remember taking a course in British Romantic poets, Wordsworth, Keats, Shelley, Byron, Blake, all of whom in their younger years, at least, were supporters of the French Revolution, which was a very dangerous thing to do in England at the time. And all we wanted to do was relate some of these poets and poems to our own experiences. And our professors wouldn't allow it, because back in those days, the prevailing method of reading literature was the New Criticism, and you really were discouraged from going outside the text. It was all about the language of the text itself.
The text itself.
So long story short, you know, our generation opened up literary criticism to a whole range of issues with psychoanalytical criticism, feminist criticism, Marxist criticism, et cetera, so that now our students can ask any question they want. But the analysis of literature became a bit politicized during these years, and the focus tended to be on ideological analysis. It was a very cerebral kind of project for students, and I thought we threw out the baby with the bathwater because we weren't appreciating the skill, the craft of the writers any longer. We really weren't talking about our own pleasure taken from the text. And at that point, I felt there was an important need to balance the analytical side with the affective side. And the best way to do that, I thought, given my background as a labor organizer, I worked in factories in Chicago for 6 years, was to go out into the community and ask ordinary people, well, what about the role of beauty in your experiences? I thought that was the best way to deal with these kinds of issues. So that was sort of the genesis of the book.
It's interesting. It seems like you've kind of turn something inside itself a little bit, because on the one hand, you are going outside of what most people would regard as the text for beauty, which would be, you know, things we might see in museums or things we might hear in a concert hall. You've gone to ordinary people, but then you've also taken that for itself. So you've kind of got both of those things going.
Yeah, I mean, I want to focus on what people's actual experiences of the object is. And, you know, the object can be a lot of different things. In fact, none of the folks I spoke with really talk about books. They talk about a lot of other things. But I asked them, what is it like to be in the presence of that object? How does it make you feel? Physically, intellectually? What prepared you for that experience? What are the results of that experience in terms of your own morals, your own political involvement, your own spiritual life? So those are some of the basic questions I ask, and people get involved in, you know, talking about some very personal experiences. And that was really the most extraordinary thing about this project was how much people trusted me with divulging some pretty personal experiences.
And they're not done anonymously. I mean, they're there, and their photographs are there. So tell me a little bit about how you chose your subjects. You mentioned some of the different things that a few of them did. But in particular, I was curious, for you, what qualifies someone to be ordinary?
Yeah, well, I struggled mightily with the title and using that word. I'm not crazy about that word, but I think it's a little better than average. By ordinary, I don't mean other than extraordinary. I really mean people who don't make a living from particular art or craft. You know, they're not professional artists in any way or writers. That's really what I meant. I just wanted to get at the fact that I was going beyond the academy into the community and having conversations with those people. In the academy, we do actually have a form of criticism called reader response, and you would think that that would take scholars out into the community, but it rarely does because the ideal reader is usually the professor himself or herself. And so, you know, the description is, you know, how professional readers experience text, not amateur readers, ordinary readers.
And you mentioned earlier that they're all from this area, and they are all from the Syracuse area, right? These folks.
Well, Gus Newport is from Rochester.
Okay.
And I think one other person is from Ithaca.
Okay.
Everybody else is from Syracuse.
From Syracuse. So and at least Central New York also. Then for the last two.
Yep.
Was that done for any reason beyond convenience? Did you kind of have an idea of you wanted to get people who are roughly in the same area to talk to? Tell me about that choice.
You know, I wasn't going to do a national kind of search for people. I didn't need to. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to go out into the community and talk to my fellow citizens. And I chose them, you know, some I chose randomly, some I read about in the newspaper. Bob and Janet Warner, they fix up old cars. I read about them in the Post Standard. Others by word of mouth. I wanted to get some representation in terms of class. I wanted to focus on the middle class and the working class. I wanted to have some diversity with regard to gender and race. And other than that, look, this is not meant to be quantitative research by any means. This is a very small group of people. But, you know, it's somewhat representative, I think, of at least aspects of our community.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Harvey Terrace, a professor of English at Syracuse University and the author of a new book titled Conversations About Beauty with Ordinary Americans. You alluded to this a few minutes ago, but I wanted to draw you out a little bit more on this. What did you learn about the experience of beauty and aesthetics that you didn't know before doing the book? What did it teach you?
You know, as I mentioned earlier, I spent a lot of time around working people. I grew up in a family. I was the first to go to college. You know, my family started out in the Bronx living in a tenement. So I kind of anticipated to some degree what I would find, you know, having known what the experiences of non-academics are like, or at least some of them. So to be quite honest, I really wasn't shocked by anything or really overly surprised. For the most part, I found my hypotheses or intuitions confirmed, you know, that beauty is an absolutely essential part in the lives of people. It helps them cope. It helps them survive. It helps them thrive. It brings meaning to their lives. You know, and being able to judge different levels of skill is very important. And, you know, all of that really in some ways goes against the grain of a lot of developments in academia over the past 40 or 50 years. Because as some people may know, the literary canon, the group of sort of privileged texts that everybody thought were classic and would usually get taught, was a very limited number of authors, didn't include very many women at all or minorities. And so we busted that open in the 60s and 70s and 80s. And thank goodness, you know, there's a much broader variety now of authors and types of books that our students can read. But we also felt that there was a hierarchy that had been established, you know, and that elite taste, you know, ruled the roost. And we wanted to overcome that. And unfortunately, we overcame that in part by discouraging judgment, by discouraging our students to take pleasure in the craft of the text. And again, I never felt that being an advocate of expanding the canon and being inclusive meant at the same time that you had to withhold judgment of the quality of the work that you were reading. Never felt that, you know, it was a zero-sum game and you had to throw one out the window in order to achieve another.
Is there one conversation that has stayed more in your head than any of the others?
I would say it was my conversation with Gus Newport. It's the first conversation in the book. Gus is a longtime activist. He was once the mayor of Berkeley, California, a friend of Malcolm X's. And when he goes into a community, he puts beauty at the top of the agenda, even above jobs. He says that in order to bring people together, in order to develop pride and community, you need to consult people on how to enhance their community, how to bring beauty to the community, how to bring artwork to the community, how to bring parks to the community. That's how you build political unity, in fact. And there's a long tradition of this, looking back at the work of Friedrich Schiller, John Rawls, Jürgen Habermas. There are lots of people who believe that, John Dewey, that aesthetic experience is actually crucial to building a just society.
And what is Gus? What is he here in Syracuse? What's he doing?
Gus is now in Rochester, I believe.
Oh, Rochester.
Where he's retired, if I'm not mistaken. I haven't been in touch with Gus for a couple of years now.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Harvey Terrace, Dean's Professor for the Humanities and English at Syracuse University. He's written a new book of oral histories titled Conversations About Beauty with Ordinary Americans. Somebody loves us all. In the first half, Harvey, you were talking about one of the things that struck you was how personal and revealing people were willing to be in speaking with you and therefore probably investing a lot of trust in you. I'm wondering whether there was one conversation that you had that was the most difficult, maybe for you or for them, just something that stands out as being a difficult time in trying to put the book together.
Well, let me preface my remarks by saying that there were no difficult conversations. Everyone was incredibly generous, was very appreciative to have the opportunity to talk about these matters, and nobody turned me down. Nobody said, no, I don't want to do this. So that was pretty amazing. I think the conversation with Lauren Austin, who was head of the Black Folk Arts Community Center, there was a little bit of tension there. Here I'm a white academic coming in, and we're talking about art that is produced by minorities in a museum that is in a minority community. And I think she believed that I was coming in with a number of assumptions about the sort of individual essence of art. Mm-hmm. And for her, art was absolutely collective. For her, African traditions are extremely important. So art was not something that was in any way separate from people's daily lives. And so when I would go to ask some questions, she would sort of challenge the question or maybe rephrase the question, you know, maybe offer other assumptions. And so, you know, I I didn't necessarily subscribe to the views or to the apparent assumptions of the questions. So I had a great deal of sympathy for her perspective. Mm. So we were able to iron out, I think, some of these issues as we spoke with one another. But that was very interesting.
Well, that's kind of a direct segue into one question I wanted to put to you, which is to kind of turn all this around and blow it up, really, in a way, in terms of how we've been talking about your book. And this thought came to me from reading parts of it. It seemed to me that this book really is more about understanding people than about understanding beauty. Mm-hmm. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. I do ask people to talk a lot about their pasts, their upbringing, their background. So, you know, there's a lot of biographical material mm-hmm. that provides ballast, I think, you know, for our conversations about beauty itself. So you certainly get both. You know, I don't really see a, you know, I wouldn't want to make too much of that distinction.
Okay.
Because, again, you know, although we don't talk about it much at all, our personal experiences with aesthetics and with beauty is a very important part of our lives. You know, the only time we talk about beauty in our society is when we talk about outward beauty, when we talk about physical beauty, and sometimes, you know, sometimes natural beauty. But our all-conquering media, for the most part, shapes those conversations. And we very rarely have a chance to sit down and talk, you know, intimately about our personal experiences with beauty. And that's what this book is doing. We find a way to talk about other provocative and controversial issues, even race and gender. We don't do it very well, but we manage to do it. We talk about relationships a lot. But it's rare that we talk about these aspects, mm-hmm. these matters. So, yeah, I learned a lot about people in these conversations, but also a lot about these aesthetic questions.
Mm. Well, maybe this is the right time to ask you about the subtitle of your book, because it's intriguing. It poses a bit of a mystery unless you know the exact reference. Somebody Loves Us All. Where does that come from and what's its significance?
So this is the last line of a wonderful poem by Elizabeth Bishop called Filling Station. And it's about a well-heeled woman who stops at a gas station, and while she's having someone fill up her gas tank, she looks into the building, and all she sees is grime and oil, and she's rather disgusted by it. But she's kind of curious, so she keeps looking, and she notices she can actually see part of the interior, and she notices a doily, she notices house plants, she notices some furniture, and she realizes that somebody is trying to beautify this place. Hmm. It's a woman, you know, most likely. It's not stated, but it's a woman. So there's a gender dimension to this. She feels a certain degree of solidarity, perhaps, with whoever this anonymous woman is. But she's also from an upper class, and so she's also kind of arch or cynical about it throughout the poem. But the last line, you know, somebody loves us all, is a pretty powerful line. And it could either refer to the woman in the house or it could refer to God. It could mm-hmm. refer to a deity that places the capacity for beauty, the need for beauty in all of us. It's not clear exactly what is meant by that line, but it's a fantastic poem about somebody who's willing to transgress the normal social boundaries and be curious about people who usually remain invisible. So she sees that these working class, this family who runs the gas station, they don't own it, they run it most likely, that they do have an aesthetic dimension to their lives. They do appreciate beauty and it brings meaning to their lives. And that's an important insight for her.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Syracuse University English professor Harvey Terrace. So you mentioned earlier that you were labor organizer in Chicago. Mm-hmm. It seems pretty clear you've been influenced and inspired in your work by Studs Terkel.
Absolutely.
And Chicago is Terkel's home city. You were also a graduate student at the University of Chicago. Did you ever cross paths with him?
Yes, I was introduced to him once, got to shake his hand, but we didn't really have a conversation. Yes, his books were a model, were an inspiration. I also learned that I tried to do a little research on him to see how he actually put together his books and what the editing process was like. And I couldn't really find any information that's a future project for me. I you know, in some ways, I'll be honest, I think some of the books are too good to be true.
yeah, I get you.
I don't want to be too suspicious, but yeah. But I think that, you know, there was some pretty active editing going on there, but I don't know for sure, and I'd love to find out.
So are there other ways in which your oral histories might be different from his, maybe from the aside from the possibility of a polishing going on there?
I hope that they're in the same ballpark when it comes to interest for the readers. That's probably very – I'm sure that – I know that's difficult to achieve. Maybe I've come close.
So more generally, oral histories, it seems to me anyway, have in some respects become more popular. In recent years, it seems. I mean, NPR, for example, they do different versions of them, and they have them come from listeners as well as their professional presenters. Is there one important key that you think to making the oral history work?
Yeah. Curiosity. You have to be genuinely curious about people's lives. That's the bottom line. You know, I have my students sometimes go out into the community, and some of them have done oral histories. And I've always debated about whether to assign a how-to book written by an ethnographer, you know, because there are a lot of do's and don'ts. But I find, you know, that, you know, if you're genuinely curious, if you genuinely admire the people you're talking with and respect them, and indeed – You're respectful of them, and you have an ability to calm them down, to make them comfortable. Those are the keys. You know, it really is just having a conversation with a tape recorder sitting on the table in between you. And if you can actually have that conversation and keep it interesting, you're going to have a pretty good result.
Well, I think you've been quite successful here. We've got a few minutes left, and I want to shift gears with you and ask you about something else while I've got you here. But first, since we're talking about the book, let's wrap this up by telling our listeners, if they're interested in this, and I hope they are, where they can find out more about it and get the book.
You can purchase the book on my author's website at www.harveyteres.com.
T-E-R-E-S?
Yes.
Yes.
And it's also available on Amazon.
Okay, great. And again, that's Conversations About Beauty with Ordinary Americans. Okay, so now here we've got a few minutes left. I want to shift gears. You've written other things too. And among your previous writings is a book titled Renewing the Left, Politics, Imagination, and the New York Intellectuals. That opens up a big topic of conversation thinking about current time. So let me just pose this question to you. Do you think the left is going through another process of renewal right now? And if so, who's leading it? Is it politicians? Some other group? Where do you think the left is right now?
Well, I think
as a student of the left,
I think Black Lives Matter has done a lot of good work. I think that politicians like Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren have really changed the national agenda when it comes to some key political issues. But I think, you know, in general, the left still can be rather limited, even sectarian when it comes to reaching out to folks who disagree with them. It's really important to have conversations with political opponents, people in the middle who you can win over to your position. And, you know, too often the left is content to talk to and satisfy one another, to preach to the converted. And, you know, unlike the 60s, although there were limits to the student movement in the 60s, some of us at least tried to reach out to the working class. That's how I ended up doing labor organizing. It's really important to reach out to either Trump supporters or people who are in the middle. And these kinds of conversations, this kind of public engagement is precisely meant to engage in public discourse and raise the level of public discourse and indicate to the public that academics do have an ability to address key social issues. They bring an expertise. They bring certain protocols with them that could be very valuable to our fellow citizens. At the same time, we have to go out there and learn from our fellow citizens and, you know, at the very least learn how to speak a language that they speak and can understand and appreciate their problems and their issues and learn how to adopt solutions to their problems along with them, not for them.
Just a few seconds left, but it sounds to me like we've circled back around to your book again, because that's the departure point for your book, is taking people where they are seriously and listening to them and to remember that somebody loves us all, right?
Yeah. You know, there have been very few literary academics who have gone out into the community to try to understand how culture works. And we do great things in the classroom. We just have to expand our purview and get involved in that public conversation a little more actively than we do now.
Again, Harvey Teress's book is Conversations About Beauty with Ordinary Americans. Somebody loves us all. Harvey, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.